Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. Thanks for listening. I hope you're keeping well wherever you are. My guest this week is Dr. Lwazi Manzi. She worked as an emergency room doctor at Somerset Hospital for 12 years before embarking on a career in film production, and today she is an executive producer for Spear Films, a position she took up last year. She made her first foray into film production with the groundbreaking and controversial Of Good Report back in 2013. More recently, she co-produced An Act of Defiance, a film about the freedom fighter Bram Fischer. Lwazi is also a founding member of Sisters Working in Film and Television, SWIFT, an organization committed to empowering women working in the industry, and is a co-chairperson of the South African Screen Federation. We chatted about her journey from medicine into film, a journey that has included, among other things, training as an opera singer when she was still at school, singing in a band called Alan Funk, and DJing. We also spoke about the role of the film producer, the challenges of making a movie, and her desire to change the narrative and content of South African film. So please now enjoy my chat with Lwazi. Lwazi, thanks for your time today. I know you've had a very busy week, and I'm catching you now on your only day off. And so I kind of feel a bit bad, actually.
Don't worry,
I'm sorry about that.
It's not a day off.
But I appreciate that. Yeah.
Thank you for having me.
I realized, actually, just this morning, I was doing a little bit of further research. I don't try and get too kind of caught up in that thing. That Stephen Charnas is a mutual friend.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was kind of, I said, I'm interviewing, and I said, I hold her in the highest regard.
Oh, man, he is, yeah, you know.
Because that goes back to your career as a musician,
yes,
then. Because he told
absolutely.
Me about this band, Alan Funk.
That's
and then
right.
I read Alan Funk, and I'm, what the hell?
That's Jeepers. Right. Yeah, no, that's now way, oh, wow. Huh? So right from high school, you know, I had a... I was trained classically, actually, in opera.
Oh, wow.
Yes, by an amazing lady by the name of Hendrika Krecha. I'll never forget her. She was this huge, she was like your typical opera singer, you know, massive lady, you know, with a huge voice.
Mm.
And she trained me.
Was this in Pietermaritzburg?
This is in Pietermaritzburg, yes.
Well, I would have never guessed that
somebody like
that existed in the,
oh, yeah,
the little
no,
backwater.
She was incredible. In fact, she, you know, her voice, it was like, you know, I keep forgetting that lady's name, but the lady who sang Barcelona with Freddie Mercury, like that,
oh, right,
you know,
yeah.
that kind of voice. And she trained me, and she always encouraged me, you know, she used to say I was very talented. I was quite classically trained, but I've always preferred jazz, you know.
Okay.
I always think of myself very much as a sort of jazz singer. But in sort of around 2005, I started really sort of, you know, just kind of dabbling quite a bit in the music industry. I started DJing, and that actually kind of, I don't know, for some reason, it kind of blew up in my world, you know, and I DJed quite a bit. And then my cousin, you know, went to a studio. She was like, oh, she wants to do poetry with this guy. Went to that studio. I met the guy, and he was actually the nephew of David Kramer. And his name was Steve Kramer. And so Alan Funk started, and Stephen Charnas was our manager.
Crazy days. Because I've written here singer, DJ, mother, doctor, producer. I mean, you've lived a whole life already.
I've lived many lives. I've lived many lives. I think I'm that cat who's lived seven lives and I've only got two left.
Oh, geez, stop, please don't say that. Were you a qualified doctor already then in 2005?
I qualified in 2006.
So while you were studying,
I was studying, I was DJing,
you were DJing and singing.
And then I actually took a gap year with Alan Funk, and we carried on. And we were fairly successful, I think. You know, it was the thing that actually broke us up was that we were becoming successful, and then it came to a point where it was like, well, everybody must leave their jobs now.
Because, you had to make a decision.
Yeah,
you know.
And then that's when the band broke up, because some people just, you know, they didn't want to take that risk.
Were you ready to take that
risk,
do you think?
I was quite ready to take the risk, but when the band broke up, I thought to myself, you know, let me go and finish internship, you know, because, you know, if they're not really willing to take the risk, then I probably shouldn't be taking it either. Let me at least finish internship, finish community service. Then at least I know that...
You've got that in the bag.
I've got it in the bag. And, you know, if I decide to do anything else, at least I can go back to medicine, you know, and then I'll be fine. So that's kind of what's really... you know, broke it all up. But yeah, otherwise, we were actually doing very well.
Cool. Now, I've got a CD, actually, that Steve sent me many, many.
Really?
I was in Stockholm at the time. Wow. Yeah, I think we visited for Christmas holiday and we ended up in Cape Town sort of by chance. And, it was cool. Cool vibes,
thanks.
Very nice. But the opera then, you were at school then? Or
yes, I was at school. And, I mean, I never did opera after school, you know. I would just sort of sing jazz and all of that. And Ellen Funk wasn't the only band I was in. When I did go into internship back at home in Pietermaritzburg, I kind of did some work with a couple of bands. And then I got into a band called Sebenza Bad, which was, you know, a jazz band. And that was very much a cover band, you know. You did standards and all of that.
Ella,
and that was good
fun. Nina Simone
And earning some money on the side and all of that. And that was good fun.
So Pietermaritzburg then.
Yes.
What are your sort of memories of that?
So I had I was.
What were your parents doing?
So my dad is an attorney and my mom is in development, in the development world.
All right.
I grew up in Mbali, actually, three.
Okay, jeepers.
And that was actually a wonderful childhood because even though, as you know, in the 80s, you know, there was all of that violence and all of that. Actually, our community somehow was very, very sheltered. It was weird. Like, we had all the violence all around and then in stage three, it was just
this little enclave
of just total peace and harmony, you know. And, you know, I'm from the last generation that grew up without sort of technology. So I had a wonderful childhood. You know, we played outside.
You were playing, forced to
look after
yourselves.
Exactly, you know, and it was just all the kids would get together and you just went outside, you played all day, and you came home in the evening, and was that, you know.
I think about it sometimes as well. When I went back to Durban a couple of years ago and I just saw sort of where we used to roam. You know, we were 8 years old, seven, eight, my little sister in tow. Like, what the hell were my parents thinking?
But
I suppose that
days,
it was
a different time. Back in those days, you know, there weren't the sinister dangers, of that we have today.
I mean, of course, I'm fully aware that we lived also highly protected lives as well in our little communities. So there's that as well. But, you know, you talk about the era of technology, and I tell my sister's kids now, you know, when I used to write my essays with pen on paper.
Exactly, pencil.
At university. They cannot get it.
They can't conceive of it. Huh?
But you do come from quite a political home as well, as I gather.
Very much so.
So, I mean, that must have been then a dangerous period as well for your parents
time? Very, very much so. In fact, I recall, so my grandmother was basically de facto, I mean, they didn't really give her a title, but she was de facto secretary of the ANC Women's League in KZN. She's actually got two streets named after her in Durban.
Yes, I read that somewhere.
And I mean, you know, she's a real, real stalwart. You know, she actually got a sort of a
Gladys
state,
Manzi.
That's right. Yeah, she got a state burial and all that kind of stuff. Very well, you know, everybody knows her.
Yeah.
And I have this, just to give you an example, I have this.
And she stayed in the country. She didn't go into exile then.
No, she was banned. Yeah, so she was in the country. Wow. She was banned for
to interrupt you.
No, please. Yeah, she was banned for good. In fact, I think she was banned twice for 10 years. At a time, you know? So she never, I mean, she couldn't even leave her house, you know, never mind the country. But yes, no, she stayed in the country. And, you know, before she died, after democracy, she was very disillusioned she still was with the ANC and all of that. But not only was she traumatized by, obviously, all of the events, but she was also very disillusioned by the party. And, you know, when she died, she was, you know, she did die quite bitter, you know, but she was still very loyal to the party, you know. She was buried in her uniform and everything, you know, so she was completely loyal. But she
when was
disappointed.
That? When did she die then?
When did she pass away again? Oh, gosh, was it, I can't remember now, actually. It was 2000 and I was in high school, so it must have been maybe 2005.
Okay.
I'm not saying 19. high school, sorry, it would have been 1997, 1998, I think. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, so she like was that. Disillusioned yeah. quite early then.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. I mean, sort of even before. Okay. Obviously, with the elections and all of that, you know, everybody there was a euphoric sentiment. But she always used to say that she was worried about the leadership. She was worried that they might go in the wrong direction. I think after Chris Hani died, you know, it was it started to be questionable what was happening in leadership. Jeez. You know. Yeah. So,
That is quite a... I mean, you speak to... I mean, I've interviewed a couple of ANC people.
Yes.
Or people who are involved, I suppose, in the struggle for liberation. Ronnie Casrals is one of them.
Yeah.
Deepak Patel, another. And, you know, as you say, you talk about that loyalty. It's difficult for those people who've been through that such pain...
Mm.
And sacrificed so much for the organization and for the country, I suppose, to then sort of face the maybe a reality they don't want to face in a way or something like
exactly,
that.
Exactly. Yeah.
You studied medicine, and then how long were you working as a doctor?
12 years I worked as a doctor. I only actually stopped completely working as a doctor in October last year.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. So this is... sort of
so I started transitioning into producing. Yeah, into filmmaking when we produced Of Good Report, which was, I was pregnant with my second son, so that was 2012, yeah.
Okay. Mm. And you studied at UCT?
I studied at UCT, yes.
What year was... What year
were you there? I graduated in 2006. I started in 2001, yeah.
Yeah, okay. What was the... experience of UCT then?
Yes, yeah.
Because, you know, it became a sort of vanguard for that whole Roads Must Fall, and I'm just... Was that
sort of...
That's
an excellent question. So, you know, I actually spoke with the Fees Must Fall movement. I actually spoke to my friend about it, and I said to her, hey, you know, how come we didn't agitate in that manner, you know? We had the same problems, you know? The problem with... issues like racism, classism, and academic exclusion is that because now it's not written in law, it becomes very, very difficult to define. Even though you're experiencing it every day, it becomes a lot more difficult to define because it sits at a very surreptitious level, right? So it becomes difficult to define and therefore difficult to redress. Yeah. So we very much experienced all of that. That, you know, it was absolutely there. And what really irritates me about UCT is that it purports to be this progressive, non-racial, egalitarian university, when it absolutely is not. You know, it's still very much stuck in its colonialist ways. But for us, we were the first sort of, or at least we felt very responsible as sort of that first, especially as a black female, that sort of first generation that was now pushing through. All of us, most of us, we were the first kids that were kind of really getting into university, or maybe just the second generation that was really getting into university, and not your traditional black universities. Now we're actually pushing into the white elite universities, you know? Yeah. So there was this responsibility for us that we actually must just get through
school. Sit down, put your head down,
get through school, and not score 50%, not score 60%, okay. Because then you're that black person who's just getting through, you know? You had to get 70%, 80%, 90%, you know, just to show that, you know, actually, you know, being black doesn't mean that you're only going to, you know, achieve at a certain level, you know. So we had things that we needed to prove in a space where there's no debate, you know. There's no debating that the person got 90%, you know. So that was really that's what we felt was our responsibility. So I think that the Fees Must Fall thing, it was coming. You know, UCT definitely had it coming.
And necessary in a way?
Absolutely necessary. It was coming. It was going to happen. These kids, it's history, you know. It's happened over and over and over again in history. You know, that you're going to get youth revolting when they find themselves... in a situation where they feel like, you know, they're not going to thrive. Mm. And youth don't feel, they know that they've got their whole futures ahead of them, so they don't feel that sense of risk of, you know, what if I get into trouble or go into jail or whatever. You know, it's like, oh, well, I've got my whole life in front of me. I can afford to take two, three, four years to revolt, because what are the risks? The risks are either I kind of, you know, get sequestrated and, you know, maybe for a few years and then I'll bounce back, or my future's going to be brighter, you know. Mm. Yeah.
I've often wondered about, I do accept fully that whole point, the point you make about that sort of insidious racism or almost exclusion that those kids were feeling. But I've often wondered if it wasn't also a concern for their futures and almost like a revolt against the government in some way, you know, that they couldn't see perhaps, you know, I'm going to be sitting here paying all this money to the university and then end up working in a call center or something like that. And
exactly.
So there were kind of a number of different things going on there at the same time.
Well, absolutely.
And I suppose the state's response of such violence was an indication of the threat that they felt in a way.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, obviously with such things, you know, with such mass revolt, it's all layers, you know. You know, you can't extricate the university away from the state, you know. Absolutely, you know, they were, and that's what I'm saying is that, you know, they are willing to take those risks because it actually is their future, you know, at stake. So, yeah.
No, because I've spoken. I mean, I actually went to UCT, pre-internet, and that was, you know, there was a different kind of agitation there, of course. Yeah. But I mean, it was so weird in a way. You know, we had the stun grenades and the shooting and whatever. But and then, you know, 25 years later or 35 years later, you think, man.
Well, that's why I said, you know, that's the irritating thing about UCT, is that it says it's one thing, but actually it's quite another. Yeah.
Had you always wanted to be a doctor?
No. When I matriculated, I got an A. And
Lots of A's.
Yeah. And, you know, when you're black and you get an A, then you have to be a doctor or an engineer or a lawyer, you know, type thing. That was it, you know. And I'd always been interested in the arts. My parents refused, you know, they didn't allow me to do any arts. Mm. So I said to myself, okay, well, I got an A and I like people and I do like science. I love science. Mm. So I thought, okay, people and science, okay, I'll be a doctor. Yeah. And that was how I decided to study medicine. Yeah,
because I mean, I've listened to a number of different interviews with people who go into the arts, and oftentimes it's not understood as being a professional path for any particularly a young child.
Absolutely,
a parent wants you to get some kind of proper
security
certification
yes.
before you go and do that silly nonsense.
Yeah. And we'll talk about it just now. So, you know, that's one of the things that we are trying to change just as an industry, as a film industry, is to actually have everybody, not just society, but, you know, also politicians, economists, etc., recognize that the creative and cultural industries is, in fact, the third biggest industry in the world.
Yeah.
If you look at China and the U.S., you know, and the way that they profit from the creative and cultural industries, you know, it's a really, really important commodity, you know, commodification of skills, you know.
And exactly, goes beyond even economics. I mean, a society that encourages thought and creativity must also be taking other, you know, almost intangible benefits.
Exactly. Well, that is the unique thing about the creative and cultural industries is that not only is it an economic multiplier, but it's also a social multiplier as well. You know? I mean, if you think about history and antiquity, and if you think about the bad things that media has done, if you look at, Hitler and what was his name? The propagandist Joseph Goebbels, you know, and how successful his propaganda campaign was. That was all media, right? Mm. That was all creative and cultural industries, you know. If it can do that, why can't it do the opposite, you know?
Yeah.
And it has done the opposite, you know. If you look at, you know, the current problems that we have, again, you know, with, you know, racism, classism, sexism, and all of that, that's all been fueled by media. And now, even worse, you know, with social media and all of that,
crazy.
look at how influential all of that is, you know, in society, you know.
Now stuff spreads like, lies spread exactly, like wildfire.
Exactly, you know, and we don't pay enough attention to that power, you know, to ensure that, it, in fact, you know, that power is harnessed in a positive manner and actually directed in a positive manner into society, you know, not just as a commodity, but, you know, as I say, as a social impact multiplier. So
how did that happen then? Were you a doctor for quite longer than I actually realized.
Yes.
I mean, 12 years, and yes. you do allude to some of the trauma and tragedy that you face being a doctor, particularly in an emergency room.
Yes.
Was it just a desire to get away from that pain that led you into film production, or was it sort of, you know, you say you sang opera as a school, as a pupil, and, you know, the band and the singing, so art and creativity and that kind of thing had always been sort of there,
yes,
in your head.
Absolutely.
Chipping away.
It had always been there, and, you know, it never stopped. And even, you know, even after Alan Funk and all of that, you know, I would, you know, I'd do little bits of jobs, you know, like I'd do some vocals for DJs, you know, and all of that. But no, actually, that was not the reason why I left medicine. The reason why was because... you know, so I've been an emergency doctor the whole time, you know, and the emergency and in state, you know,
yeah.
I did very little private work.
Mm. And was that here in Joburg?
It was here. No, not here in Joburg. So it was, I'm thinking we're in Cape Town. It was in Cape Town. I was mostly at Somerset Hospital.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is a really, I mean, Somerset Hospital actually is the busiest hospital in South Africa. It's actually even busier than Barra,
sure.
You know, by headcount, you know.
Wow, okay.
By footfall, yeah.
Yeah.
Most people don't realize that.
No, I did not.
Yeah, yeah. The last professor that I worked under, he used to work at Barra, and he was like, you know, Barra's hectic and all of that, but actually Somerset the turnover at Somerset is intense, you know. And the thing is about being an emergency doctor, in that room, in state hospitals, you see the culmination of all the injustices of the world. Poverty, social, you know, all sorts of social injustices, it all culminates in that emergency room, you know. We saw everything,
yeah,
from malnourished children to interpersonal violence, trauma, and all that kind of stuff. And in interacting with people, I mean, these are all black people, it's not white, you know. And in interacting with people, I realized that actually black people are really mentally, like, completely traumatized, you know.
Yeah.
You know, years and years of colonialism.
It's the legacy of our history.
Exactly, and subjugation and, you know, just the corruption of the mind has actually led to disease and interpersonal violence, you know. And when I realized this, you know, I became very frustrated. You know, me, I'm a natural born leader. I like to do things that have mass impact, you know. And the whole thing about the one-on-one revolving door syndrome, it was actually like killing me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, no, I can't do this anymore. So I said to myself, what am I going to do, you know? And then, you know, I found myself in the film industry, and then I said, okay, fine, you know, this is actually how I can help. You know, this is for me to get into the black mind and begin to deconstruct all of that colonial trauma, or rather trauma from, you know, colonial corruption, and then begin to reconstruct it again. You know, that's what I can do.
Yeah.
You know, for Africans, and you know, the media industry is a space where I can do that, and. And going into the film industry, that is what I have been pushing. You know, this is what I push for. I push for us to really, really get into a place where we're no longer concentrating on plight-driven narratives, and we start to actually, you know, put ourselves in a space where our narratives are a lot more uplifting and innovative and, you know, just I'm sorry, I'm just losing the word. I'll think about it now. But, you know, your Black Panthers, for instance, you know, that's the kind of narrative we need to be shifting.
Affirming.
You know, so it's self-affirmation, it's advanced, it's, you know, it puts Africans in a light where we're no longer seen sort of as the dark continent, you know. We're actually seen as innovators and, you know, and futurists and, you know, and wealthy, not just wealthy in you know, economically, but wealthy also in
intellectually.
So, you know, that's really what I fight for as I go through life as a producer.
Because, I mean, you know, there's the classic tale of how do you make $1 million in the music industry, and you start with 10 million.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it's not the easiest path you've chosen for yourself,
no,
but you're definitely on a mission.
Yes.
And before we get into some of the particular movies, maybe we can just tell me a little bit about, because you're a producer, and I mean, we always see that, you know, it's directed by and it's produced by. You're like the sort of, the big dog of the film. But maybe just if you could explain to me and the people listening, what is the role of a producer? What do you do?
Yes. it's funny, I actually asked that question when I was still at university. I was like, what do producers do? Like, and producers could never actually tell me. They're like, well, no, we produce, you know.
Yeah, no.
No, it's very simple, actually. You know, every picture, every film, anything that you see on television is its own company, right? So the producer is the CEO of that company. Right.
So you change CEO positions every movie?
Every movie, yeah.
Yeah.
So every movie, I'm the CEO of that company.
Right.
That's really what a producer is. Yeah. So when you think of it that way, then people are like, oh, okay, I understand now. Yeah, so your job is to ensure that you bring together all the right people. And you know, you appoint, like, your line producer is your financial manager, right? So you appoint, usually what we do when we produce, I mean, movies come to us in different forms, but normally it'll be like, okay, a director comes to us, writer, a director comes to us and says, oh, no, they want to make this movie. Great. Then we raise the money.
Yes, I suppose that's one of the most important tasks
you
have is
exactly,
getting
the
money in the first place, right?
We raise the money.
And then you have to manage the...
We will normally appoint a line producer who's essentially your financial manager. And then that line producer generally will then, you know, appoint the rest of the crew and all of that, you know. And this is now very simply put, just to help people understand. Yeah. But that is your job, is to raise the money.
Right.
And to look after the overall management of that production
right.
as well.
Yeah. So it's fascinating. I mean, as I'm saying, the realization that there are these sort of standalone companies that you may well work with the same people again and again at certain levels, but it's its own new animal every single time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, but remember that, okay, most films, 80%, 90% of films, you know, or television or whatever, okay, no, maybe not television, but let's talk about films. Most of them, you know, it's just that once off they release and that's that. But if you have a big franchise, you know, like your Star Wars, and all
Avengers
of that, you know, that goes on forever.
Yeah.
You know, so you can't have it, you know, be bleeding into other business. It has to be its own thing, you know. So that as you're exploiting and all of that, you have very, very good control over the financial management of that. Yeah, and also, you know, all the other things that you need to manage with big franchises. So, you know, so it's for that reason that you know, every film must be its own entity.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then, do you have a role in the casting of the film or the actual script? I mean, do you have input into the script and things
like that?
I mean, at what level are you,
you
kind of quite...
So every producer, you know, every producer has a different approach. You know, there's some producers who consider themselves creative producers and they really, you know, get involved.
So like micromanage.
In everything I wouldn't say... I wouldn't say micromanage. I would just say, you know, they're collaborative, you know,
right.
with everybody, you know, and that's fine, you know. That's, you know, I prefer myself. I love casting, by the way, but the other reason why we do need to sort of be involved in casting as producers, and particularly when we're doing sort of, you know, bigger pictures and or television and all of that, is for the sales projections, you know,
right.
Because, you know, unfortunately, you know, just it's just the way it is. Your sales are dependent on your lead cast. You
star.
Know?
Yeah, exactly. You need a star, basically.
You need your stars so yeah. to be able to sell. So,
yeah.
And you know, the sales companies and the financiers in the industry, that's just how, you know, that's how they manage their business models, you know.
Yeah.
So we tend to make sure, you know, that we have oversight over that, at least, you know.
Mm.
I quite like to cast. I enjoy casting, but that's really as far as I go. I generally prefer to, you know, be hands
be quite
off.
Hands
yeah,
off, yeah.
In the creative side, I prefer to just take care of the business, you know.
Mm.
And I let you know, and the way that I manage it is that I always choose to work with creatives that I implicitly trust, you know. And then I prefer to just, you know, trust them to actually execute what they need to execute. So, you know, some people have worked with me. Like recently, I've just done a short, you know, and I saw the director. Sometimes she'd just look at me like, you know, because I'm so hands off. She'd be like, "Is she for real?" type thing, you know. But yeah, but I prefer to just, and also I think directors like it when producers just let them be, you know.
Mm.
Yeah.
So. Do you? You're talking about your sort of mission, I suppose, to sort of empower people within the industry and empower,
yes.
Empower the creativity of African filmmakers, etc.,
yes.
and creatives. How do you then choose the movies you work on? Because I mean, one of the first movies you worked on as a producer was the film Of Good Report,
mm-hmm.
and then you've also recently done The Act of Defiance, the Bram Fischer story.
Yes.
I've fortunately have watched both of those movies, Of Good Report, just yesterday, and I'm still kind of recovering, I suppose.
Yeah.
I haven't fully formed my analysis, I don't think, of the movie, but I mean, it's a pretty damn gritty.
Mm.
It's uncomfortable.
Mm.
It's terribly dark, violent. I mean, most of the male characters are awful at whatever level. The alcoholic teacher, the murdering psychotic psychopathic teacher, come to mind. Even that young boyfriend who thinks he's an American rapper or whatever. You know, I thought that was quite funny. Actually, yeah, dog. What,
yeah.
You know what I mean? You do.
Yeah. And you get them.
I think. And then Bram Fischer. You know, a different time, a different pace. But I suppose brutality is the common thread, unfortunately, that I get from those movies.
Mm.
And I suppose, I mean, you are saying we have to still confront the brutality of our past in a way?
Yeah, so, okay, so let me just, we'll take a couple of steps back, because my history of being in the industry, so with Of Good Report, you know, I just found myself in there because just by virtue of proximity, I was married to the filmmaker at the time.
Jamal.
Yes, that's right, yeah. So, yeah, he's the father of my children, so.
Oh, right, okay.
with Of Good Report, I really liked the film because it was a different kind of filmmaking that I hadn't seen in South Africa, you know, and this was still just when he was writing it, and I really like dark films myself,
mm-hmm.
personally, and I like dark gritty films because I really like. I like to study corrupt minds, you know, and because I've been there, you know, I've seen it, you know.
From your hospital days.
Yeah, from our hospitals and all of that. And I really like just splattering open nasty truths. And I like pushing audiences to look at themselves, you know. Because whenever you feel uncomfortable, it's not that thing. It's the truths that are being... that opened up inside of you, you know, and I really liked that. And I mean, you know, as the script was being written, you know, I just thought it was just outstanding. And I really
it's beautifully shot as well, I have to say.
Beautifully shot. Jonathan Coval shot it as he shot So the Winter as well.
Right, Jonathan.
Jonathan Coval is amazing. Yeah, he's an amazing, amazing cinematographer.
Yeah. And black and white this time.
Yeah, and
as
in
well,
black and white. And actually, black and white, that was my idea because.
Is it? I was going to wonder about the choice.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, basically, Of Good Report is kind of like our iteration of Lolita.
Yes, and exactly. Because there's Nolita.
So it was kind of like our sort
character.
Of. Yeah.
And I kind of got that. Yeah.
Yes. And I really, you know, I thought black and white was going to just remove all the bullshit and just, you know, let us just get straight into it, you know, and also just, you know, give us that feeling of grit as well, you know, and I think it worked very nicely. So then there was that film, and I think it surprised a lot of people because of the style of filmmaking was something that, you know, we hadn't seen in South Africa. And I really like to encourage people to say, hey, we can make these kind of films. You know, you don't have to make, you know, that, you know, like the kind of films that we make, which is more didactic, that TV, you know, very square. No, you know, you can actually make films
push
that
the boundaries
you can
a
really
bit.
Push yourselves, you know. So I really like the fact that we're pushing ourselves. I love to push. Now, we haven't only made gritty films. We've also made romantic comedies, you know, all sorts of genres. You know, we did Love Jacked with...
That's the one. Unfortunately, I didn't want to talk about it because I haven't seen it.
So we've done, right now we're doing very light entertainment action television series, for your 8 o'clock, you know, subprime time. Sort of family viewing. So we've done all the genres except science fiction and animation. No, actually, we've done animation. We did Kumba. I think science fiction is the only thing we haven't done, but we're getting there.
You've got to do a zombie movie one of these days.
Yeah, we're
going to
do a zombie movie in December. And that's
no, really? Seriously?
Yes, yeah. That's going to be a teen flick. A teen flick zombie movie that's going to be based in Benito Rage. That's going to be fun. Every time I tell people this film, they start laughing already. You know, they're like, oh my God, we can't wait to see it.
That sounds classic.
So that's going to be good fun. You know, so we've done all the genres. And you know, and again, what it boils down to is I just love to push boundaries, you know. Everywhere I go, we're wanting to push, you know. Whether it's dark or light or whatever, all I want to do is I just want to get us out of, you know, being stuck in a rut.
A linear kind of.
Exactly, as filmmakers.
And there's now, you seem to be developing some sort of Dutch connection. I mean, the Bram Fischer movie was a sort of Dutch co-production. And then I see on the IMDb, there's some sort of Commando, what's it called?
Commandos, yes. Okay, so let me just...
So that's also sort of Dutch...
Yes, so it's not just the Dutch. It's not just the Dutch. We like to co-produce because we like to own IP, you know. So as opposed to your sort of bigger service company, your bigger companies which service, you know, that's what they do. When you see the big Hollywood pictures being shot here, that's usually a service job, you know.
Right. We're
basically just glorified sort of project managers, you know. You take your fee and that's it. And I don't like that. I really don't like that because that does not grow the industry. It has not grown the industry. It has not done the industry any favors. The only thing it's done is it's maybe brought in some foreign direct investment through, you know, the incentive schemes and all of that. But it has not actually contributed to transformation. It has not really grown the industry because you don't participate down the line. You just charge a fee, off they go. And, you know, they come here, they shoot their big, Hollywood pictures, and they make $2 billion, you know, worldwide sales and all of that kind of stuff, you know. We don't get a cent of that. You know, we've just gotten small fees and that's
flat
it.
Fee and
that's not what we're about as Spear Films. Yeah. You know, we're about owning IP, participating down the line, co-producing. So we co-produce using the treaties that have been put in place with other jurisdictions. So the Dutch, the Irish... we've co-produced with them. We did a picture called The Harvesters as well, which went to Cannes. It was selected for Un Certain Regard. That was with the French that we co-produced with.
Right.
Yeah. And then, of course, we've co-produced with Canada. We're actually going to do a second co-production now with Canada in October. You know, so the Dutch is just one of the
relationships.
But we do have a good relationship with the Dutch. Yeah. Yes, we do.
And I suppose, I mean, the benefits. What do you see as the benefits of co-producing with other countries? I mean, is there a sort of transfer of knowledge? Are you learning?
Exactly.
Are your people learning?
You've got the exchange of skills. So they're learning from us, we're learning from them, you know. You've got immediate access to markets. So, you know, you're not just constrained by just our small South African or even a small African market. You immediately are, you know,
international. You've got some foot in the international door.
Excuse me. We share resources. So they raise money, we raise money. They use their tax incentives, we use our tax incentives. And I mean, you know, co-producing, by the way, you know, people, I don't know why people think co-producing is this sort of niche business. It's not. Everybody, that's how films are made now. Everybody co-produces. But people think of co-producing as co-producing between jurisdictions and territory. No. The big conglomerates, your Disneys, your Comcast and all of that, those are conglomerates. Those are huge, massive conglomerates. And all of these companies co-produce with each other. They also co-produce with other companies that are not in the industry. To give you an example, the Ninjago series, or the Ninjago franchise, sorry, is Warner Brothers and the Lego Company. Co-production. Right. Yeah, so these all of these big Hollywood blockbusters that you see, they're all co-productions. They're just between private entities, you know.
Yeah.
And for any filmmaker, whether you're a small indie company like ourselves or a big Comcast, to compete with your Netflixes and your Amazons and all of that, who have mounds and mounds of money to pump into high-end properties. You have to share resources, you know. So everybody, you know. So co-production is actually sine qua non of actually filmmaking now.
Yeah, no, I was just sort of more just commenting on that, and I suppose from a positive point of view, it's good to realize that people are interested in co-producing with African filmmakers, that they do see it as a positive and relevant thing to do, I suppose.
Very
that was
much
my
so.
Kind of reflection on that.
Very much so. So those of us who are interested in owning IP, participating down the line, actually being able to actually get profits, you know, we co-produce.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose one thing that a lot of people do not realize, well, I'm speaking for myself, I suppose, I don't want to, is that it is damn expensive.
Oh, yes.
To make a movie.
Oh, yes. It's very expensive. I mean, right now, this television series that we're shooting is $27 million, and it's not enough money. You know, and this is a 10-part, one-hour series. And that's actually, you know, by Hollywood standards, that's a medium-sized production, sort of high production. Game of Thrones cost over $100 million to make. And that was only 6 parts.
Where did the sort of, I mean, if do you see a trend in where the expenses come from? Or does it change from movie to movie? Is it about, if you've got a lot of location shoots once, or a star here, or CGI in another? I mean, does the sort of percentage of the expense change from film to film, depending on what kind of film you're making?
It does change. So, yeah, I mean, with the high-end filmmaking, those properties, There's no simple formula.
No.
Let me put it that way.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. If you balance it out.
Yeah. So there isn't really a simple formula. Let's use our television series as an example now. To get a big, our stars are big stars, but not they're A-list stars, but they're not the absolute top. You know, they cost $1 million just to have them.
Just to roll up.
So a huge chunk of your expenses go towards the stars.
And especially with our exchange rate, then that must be killing.
Yeah, no, it's a killer.
Yeah.
Location-based shows are expensive, but your studio-based shows can also be expensive. It depends on, you know, what you're building and what you're doing.
Yeah.
Obviously animation is extremely expensive.
Yeah, that's another thing I think people don't realize. You know, I think let's animate it, it'll be cheaper.
Oh,
I mean,
I've been
in corporate environments where people say, let's just do a quick animation, you know.
Exactly, yeah. No, yeah, you know, whenever animators get, you know, corporates coming, oh, you know, we just want a little quick. And
it's 3-minute animation.
It's like, no, just to get 1 minute takes weeks and weeks, you know. And it's very expensive, you know. Movies nowadays, you know, there's a lot of animation actually in live action movies, you know, CGI and animation are the same thing, really. And that's expensive. So, yeah, I mean, filmmaking is expensive. It's just an expensive exercise, you know. Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, is that our industry, our South African industry, that is the problem that it suffers from, is that there's not enough investment into our films and our filmmakers, you know. Yeah. I mean, 10 million rand for the $1 million for a film.
You just
can't, you know. And then, of course, there's the expense of marketing and distribution. In fact, when you hear a film like a Hollywood blockbuster saying that, oh, that film cost $200 million, $300 million, actually, about 60% of that money is actually marketing and distribution.
Whoa.
Yeah. The other 40% is making
actual
the film.
Production.
Yeah, it's the production.
Well, you hear about, I mean, when the Academy Awards come around, I mean, Elias was talking to me about The Wound and how they were, you know, how they for once had this
marketing drive, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that they could actually, and of course they hit the buffers with that whole reaction and banning of the film and all that, that came at an awful time for them.
Mm-hmm.
But that, yeah, that made me consider for the first time, you know, that all these films that win the awards actually, you know, you wonder sometimes about the integrity of that whole process, if there's so much money involved in the actual push.
That's another podcast. That is another podcast. Yeah, awards and all that whole world.
It can
get very corrupt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me think now. Yeah. So let's maybe just get some of your sort of perspectives now on the state of South African film. And I want to particularly put it in the context of I've mentioned The Wound and we've discussed Of Good Report. Both of those movies were banned, not completely, but they were taken out of cinemas for various reasons. Of Good Report was classed as being pornographic, and I have to say, I mean, I don't know if the version that I saw was
the version.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's that, and then The Wound, of course, also, you know, was attacked from a sort of traditional cultural kind of perspective, although I think probably the issue there was the fact that the protagonists were gay, and people in this country still do not want to accept the fact that there are gay people in there living around them, just as I suppose Of Good Report didn't want to confront the issue of
sugar daddies.
Sugar daddies, of women, young girls being taken advantage of, older men, and of violence against women at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Where do you
Because,
I mean, the state has a role in supporting film, and then you have that at the same time.
Yeah. So, since Of Good Report, I have had quite a positive relationship, I would say, with the Film and Publication Board. The problem with the Film and Publication Board is that its laws, the way that its laws are written, are very problematic. You know, it's very, I would say, first of all, that they're archaic and they need to be, and this is very true for the law anyway in South Africa, you know, is that there's so much that we've adopted from, like, you know, colonial past and colonial antiquity and then apartheid and all of that that hasn't been changed and that hasn't moved with the times.
That sort of is even out of step with our constitution in a way.
Out of step with our constitution. That was the problem with our country, is that when we went through the transformation phase, tip of the iceberg sort of approach, you know. And we didn't quite delve deep into our laws and our scriptures and the way that they've been written and all of that to make sure that they're actually in line with our progressive constitution. So we often find ourselves, and this is not just with the film industry, but, you know, across the board, we find ourselves, oh, You know, you've done something and now you're being prosecuted for it, but you thought that you had the rights to do that because our constitution says that. And then people have to fight their way all the way to the Constitution Court to have those decisions. Who's got that money? Who's got that time? Who's got those resources? You know, only the rich, you know. So that's why, you know, even just us middle classes, you know, we have a problem, you know, in that if we find ourselves in a legal fix, we might not be able to get out of it, even though actually constitutionally we have a right to do that.
Yeah.
And that is what happened to Of Good Report, and that's what happened to Inxeba as well, you know.
I think it's, I mean, I've mentioned this in a couple of other discussions I've had. It's almost like I'm not sure that the government or the state have done enough work in selling our constitution and what our constitution stands for, because we are such a conservative country, and that again is a legacy, I think, of many things, of traditional cultures and colonial oppression and this whole kind of sick morass that we are still living in. I mean, I'm fairly convinced if you took a referendum today to bring back the death penalty, it would be back.
Yeah.
Or to ban gays, that would be banned.
Yeah.
If you took it to the people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So those are the kinds of things.
Yeah. Isn't it? I mean, the world is shifting right. It's actually incredible, you know. But, you know, the thing is that what we need to recognize as a society and worldwide as well is that there's many of us now. There's lots of us, you know. And therefore, resources are becoming scarcer and scarcer. And people are becoming very concerned about their own self-preservation. And that's why there's now the shift to nationalism, you know, just worldwide, you know. It's people just trying to protect their national resources, you know, that they have on hand. And, you know, and that's just on a basic survivalist level. But then it's now also gone into our psyche and our mentality, you know, and the way that we just approach life and each other in general. Yeah. So it's going to be tough. I think, you know, the times to come are going to be not what we hoped for. You know, it's going to, you know, unless there's a real recognition of this fact and we really start to address, you know, economics and all, you know, the things that are causing people to feel insecure, you know, in general, and we address the wealth gap.
Yeah,
it's just going to continue to become more and more nationalist and conservative.
Another one of the struggles, or another one of your commitments, I suppose, is to specifically the role now of women in the South African film industry. And you are a founding member of SWIFT, of the Sisters Working in Film and Television.
Yes.
Could you just give me an idea of what the role and purpose of SWIFT is?
Absolutely, So SWIFT, it was DIFF 2000 and... Where are we now? 2019, right?
Was it 16, I think?
2016, yeah. You know, women started to articulate their feelings and grievances of trying to survive in the film industry, you know. I mean, you know, I've always been a producer in the industry, so therefore always in a position of power.
Mm.
I don't know what it's like to be a continuity person, you know, or to be a PM or to be a runner as a woman.
On the ground.
It must be so hard, you know. So that, you know, they really just started to express themselves. They said, oh, you know, we should actually have an organization. Now, SWIFT is not the first one. I think there were Sisters of the Sun or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, before, and I don't know, some other ones which collapsed. So, you know, we all got together and we said, okay, we don't just want an organization, you know. We really, really want to ensure that we have almost a social enterprise, you know. And, I mean, what I always said as a founder, as I said, you know, we really need to think of SWIFT more as an enterprise, a business, you know, than, you know, kind of like an NPO type of thing. You know, we need to make sure that it makes money and that it is, in fact, all empowering to women, you know. And, you know, when I spoke to them, I said to them, you know, we need a bank, you know. We need to think about actually having kind of like Borland Bank. I'll think of the name now, but it's basically, you know, sort of that community sort of banking
system. Cooperative,
exactly, a cooperative. They call them credit unions.
Credit union.
Yeah, so, you know, we need to think about having a credit union. We need to think about having our own channel, you know, that kind of thing, you know, so that it really is empowering. So when we started SWIFT, we really, you know, went into it with that mentality, you know. So in 2016, you know, there was a call for it. We took our time to formulate SWIFT and really, really anchor it and have all the pillars in place. And then a year later, it was launched. And now, you know, it's got hundreds of members, you know, and you know, we, you know, all the time we get asked, you know, when is it going to be SWIFT Africa? When are you going to expand beyond South Africa, et cetera, et cetera?
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, so there was a real... I don't want to call it aggressive, but it was, you know, a real aggressive stance we took, you know, to say that, you know, this thing really needs to be empowering, you know. And it's amazing, you know. So SWIFT is actually, for me, it's one of the things that I'm most proud of, having being one of the founding members, board members. But I'm just really proud of SWIFT, you know. It is just so empowering.
Because you produced a report as well,
and then
interviewed a number of women working in film. I mean, some of the statistics that came out of that in terms
shocking.
Of the
sexual
harassment
and shocking. So, I mean, we've tackled sexual harassment. We still need to move on to other stuff. You know, there's still, you know, racism and sexism and all of that, and then, of course, there's still problems that are experienced by members of the LGBTQI community as well, you know. So we're still going there, you know. But yes, the first study that we did was on sexual harassment, and we found that 67% of women in the industry have been one way or another sexually harassed. There were a couple who reported being raped on set, you know.
Jeep.
It was just shocking, absolutely shocking. But we all knew it, you know. It's just that when it's pointed out to you in statistics, it's just like, oh, my God, you know. So then that's how the PSAs then came about, because then it was a matter of we really need to – because, again, it's a mentality thing, you know. It's not just about the sexual harassment.
Yeah,
it's about
the
way
not
people
okay.
– Exactly,
yeah,
right. So then the That's Not Okay campaign was really about educating people on – what it is. And again, it's that subliminal messaging, you know. That's where the problems are.
It's chauvinism, isn't it?
Exactly.
I mean, it's like ingrained chauvinism.
Exactly.
It's like people who are responsible for that kind of behavior would never see it or never recognize it.
No, they don't realize. And, you know, they don't realize the trauma that they're causing, you know. Just a comment, you know, that is harassing can cause that woman to, like, you know, underperform for like months, you know, because she's traumatized, you know. That's why we called it That's Not Okay, because people just think it's okay, you know, to touch somebody's breasts or, you know, to make jokes about your penis or, or whatever, you know. That's just one of the campaigns. Of course, you know, it took up a lot of our time and resources as an organization, because it is such a big problem and because it is quite sensational, and it made the news and all of that kind of stuff.
But it's a reality.
It's a reality and all of that, and it absolutely had its time and place, and we need to continue with campaigning all of that, and we are. You know, there's another lot of PSAs that have just been shot. But we actually got other issues to address. You know, one of the, like, for instance, you know, racism. And, you know, one of the things that SWIFT does recognize is that, you know, there is wealth and access gap, you know, between races, you know.
Yeah.
And we need to recognize that as a white female, you're not in the same place as a black female, you know. And we actually need to ensure that as we are devising our programs and all of that, that they actually speak to those realities as well. Then we still, as I say, we still need to address the LGBTI thing, you know. That's also a whole nother, you know, whole nother can of worms that, you know, LGBTI community is very much harassed in the industry as well, you know.
These are sort of societal issues as well, aren't
they? Yes,
there,
there are societal issues. And that's the thing, again, with the film industry, is that the film industry is like a...
A little melting pot
of all societal issues, you know. It's
a reflection, you know.
Very much so, yeah.
Interesting. I want to just touch a little bit, but we need to finish off now.
Oh, and sorry, the pay gap as well between men and women. Yeah, you know, so that's why we were talking about banking and all of that, and you know, and also the fact that, you know, women are so vulnerable because it's such a, you know, there's no protection in the film industry. Our industry is not unionized, you know, so there's no pension and this and that. You know, you just kind of move from job to job, and you have to look after yourself. You know, you have to look after your future. When you get pregnant, there's no maternity leave, you know. You don't get paid to, you know, to be pregnant and to have babies and all of that. You know, so we've got all of that as well to deal with.
So just looking ahead, I mean, what are your hopes now for the South African film industry? I mean, it's always been, I mean, I suppose Tsotsi was a very important moment for the South African film industry all those years ago. And I suppose, I mean, I'm a little naive in how much film is actually produced in this country, locally produced film. It is a thriving industry, but what do you sort of anticipate for the next, say, 5 years?
Yeah.
Particularly now as distribution models are changing, obviously technology is going to start playing much more of an influence as well. Are those good things for the industry, and how would you sort of piggyback on those kinds of developments?
The thing about the fourth industrial revolution is that what it's going to do is all the issues that we've discussed now, it's just going to augment them, okay? Especially for African countries, okay? We need to ensure that we watch that very carefully and we have strategies in place as a country to be able to mitigate the increased wealth gap, you know, access to technologies, access to platforms, and our participation in the advancement of technologies, you know, that we're not actually just consumers, that we actually are also, you know, participants of these expanding technologies. Because that's what's going to happen is that the problem with our industry, and this is also a problem anyway across the sectors, is that we're very much a consumerist society, you know. And that makes us not wealth growers, you know. So we really, really need to watch that. Now, the film industry is a very complex industry, you know, in terms of what you need to do to actually just make a movie, okay? And our industry is, unfortunately, is enmeshed with government, you know. We can't do anything without government. We need those incentives. Otherwise, we actually can't make films. We need the FPB to play ball with us. We need the state banks. We need the NEF. We need the IDC and all of that. The PIC, there was talk of PIC also coming on board as well. We need the laws to allow us to, you know, actually make films the way that we want to make them, you know. But not even just to express ourselves, but actually laws into business laws, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, we have problems there as well. Critically, we need access to international markets immediately, you know. Like from the time that you release a picture, you cannot just be confined by South Africa and Africa. Our markets are too small, okay. And then we need to collaborate with African countries who also don't have money as well. I mean, you know, most of the other countries, we don't have treaties with African countries because, frankly, they just don't have the resources to be able to share resources with us, you know. So we spend a considerable amount of time discussing how we're going to ensure that we can compete on the international stage, because we have to, you know, otherwise, you know. Oh, sorry, and we also need a state broadcaster that works. Because if you don't have a state broadcaster that works, then, you know, I mean, a state broadcaster is your bedrock of the industry. You know, that's where you grow up, that's where you incubate.
Right. It's a lab for skills.
Exactly. You know,
skills development as much as distribution.
Just look at the BBC. Yeah. I mean, that's just look at how the BBC has an international footprint. That's a state broadcaster that is internationally entrenched, you know. I was at the BBC Americas just recently, and it's just phenomenal how they actually just do things. So Wow, you know, that's a lot of things. That's a lot of cross sectors, exactly. Yeah. You know, so I mean, you know, I've been in leadership and organized industry since I started in the industry. So you know, I'm head of SASFED. I've been chair at the IPO as well, and all of that. We spend a lot of time discussing how are we going to bring all of these entities together so that we are all on the same page and we are having this discussion and everybody understands. It's very hard. Mm. We work with people. The majority of the people that we work with in these entities have never been in the film industry. They don't understand.
They're just kind of bureaucrats.
Yeah, they're bureaucrats. You know, they are just pure bureaucrats. So you can imagine the extreme frustration of trying to explain to them why we need to ensure that we actually make the kind of time, resource, investments so that we can compete with the Black Panther. We can compete with the Star Wars, you know. We can compete with the Netflix series, you know, original series and the Amazon original series and the Apple original series and all of that, who are pumping huge. I mean, these businesses, right, your Disneys and all of that, who make a lot of money. The money that they make, that they grow, 60% of that money goes back into the business, yeah. Right? You know, that's how are we going to compete with that? You know, unless we really are all collaborative,
focused.
You know, focused, understand, you know, the very, very fast shifting models, you know, understand, you know, the platforms that we need to supply content to and how they work and, you know, and how they do things. And understand what kind of resources need to go in and understand that this is a commodity. This is a business. We are, you know, we really need to, it is a very, very big industry, third biggest industry. I mean, that's the first thing I think that needs to happen. It's just the mentality of creative, cultural and creative industries, you know. When you think of motors or you think of agriculture, you know, you think of industry. You know, you think of machines and all of that and industry and making money and getting GDP and all of that. The creative and cultural industries is exactly the same, you know. It's not just some kind of, you know. It's a huge, big machine, you know, that as we said, you know, that is also a social impact multiplier. So, you know, you need to really, really invest the resources into it and understand how it is that you're actually going to get your return on investment as well and ensure that your strategies talk to, you know, your machinery, you know, and your models. Mm-hmm. So I'm very worried about the state of the industry. We operate on an international stage anyway to try and circumvent all of these problems, but we can't get away from it because, as I say, we have a very enmeshed relationship with the state. So we work very, very hard. You know, we get involved in organized industry so that, you know, we can try and, you know, speak to all of these problems, you know, and try and collaborate with government, with private entities as well, you know, to ensure that we all kind of work together so that we can actually compete and also, you know, kind of join that top three, you know. So it's very complicated, as you can hear, but I think if we apply ourselves and if, you know, if we really just shift that paradigm in our heads, you know, and really, really start to think of the industry, you know, as something that can be very, very positive for our economy, you know, then we have a chance. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Lwazi, thanks so much for your time today.
No, thank you. It's an honor.
Really a pleasure meeting you, and I wish you all the best for your upcoming projects.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Have a good weekend.
And you too.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. She said she's a natural-born leader, a lot of energy. She's done a lot. She's got a lot of things ahead of her as well, it seems. She's certainly not afraid of speaking her mind. She has some clear ideas on what she feels needs to be done to make the South African film industry more relevant, more competitive, you know, getting all the relevant players to, I suppose, work in a more constructive way together. It'll be interesting to follow her career as it unfolds. I think it was interesting to hear how she feels political appointments or just bad appointments in relevant government agencies seem to be hindering the evolution of the film industry, just as they have done, unfortunately, in other sectors of our economy. Voices from SA is hosted on Audio Boom. You may subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Radio Public, Deezer, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.